It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for your support during today's year-end mini-pledge drive. 1,100 of you pledged for a total of over $156,000. We are so grateful for your support.
If you haven't yet pledged, you can do so at WPR.org and make your year-end gift.
Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to an author of many hit zombie books, including World War Z. He's speaking in Madison tonight and will join us to talk about the appeal of the apocalypse.
But first, we're talking about a story out of Marathon County. A deer killed on a hunting reserve there tested positive for chronic wasting disease, or CWD.
It's the first case of CWD found on a Wisconsin game farm in 5 years.
Covering the story for WPR News is Glenn Moberg, a reporter based in Wausau. He's with us now to fill us in. Glenn, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, hi, Cynthia. Hi, Rob. It's good to be here.
Well, first of all, can you explain why it's significant that we found CWD on a farm preserve?
Well, this is the first time they found an infected deer on a game farm in Wisconsin since October of 2008. So it's a pretty rare situation, and it's significant because, of course, they're worried that this disease will spread to other animals. And if you have a herd of animals confined behind chain link fences, even under a situation where there are lots of acreage involved. In this case, there was 351 acres on this hunting preserve. The worry is that it will spread easily to large numbers of animals. And in fact, that did happen back in 2006 in another central Wisconsin incident. There were 82 deer that got infected by chronic wasting disease on a game farm in Portage County, and all of those animals were eventually destroyed.
Mm. Do we know that that deer came or belonged to that herd, or might it have been a wild deer that had gone astray and entered that area?
No, they don't think that's possible. Okay. Because the hunting preserve had and has a double chain link fence around it as required by law. So they don't think the animals have gone in and out of that preserve. But it was shot by a hunter on the preserve on November 4th. And then according to the Department of Agriculture rules, there's routine testing that takes place. So on November 7th at the National Veterinary Services lab in Ames, Iowa, it did turn up positive. So what they've done right now is they have quarantined that farm. It's a 351-acre hunting preserve, and it's near Eland, which is on the Marathon County, Shawano County border. And they've also quarantined three other nearby game farms that are affiliated with the same owners. They're not identifying the owners at this point, but from my understanding, the owners will be allowed to continue to have hunts on the preserve. Because the infected deer, if they're killed, well, they're not going to move anywhere, and they'll stay on site and have no contact with other animals outside of the game farm. But that quarantine will keep the deer on those preserves from moving from area to area while the state conducts its investigation.
Mm. And looking at that timeline, so the tissue was submitted for testing on November 7th. It's December 3rd, 4th? I've lost track of the day already. Nearly a month.
It takes a while.
Nearly a month. And what kind of damage might be done to the deer that are still living there in that time frame?
Well, they're going to have to do some tests. They're going to have to find out if the disease has spread. And the thing that we need to stress here is that the disease, chronic wasting disease, cannot be spread to human beings. As far as all of the scientific evidence we have, the Department of Health still recommends that venison from infected deer not be consumed, but that's precautionary. There's been no incident reported in which human beings have come down with chronic wasting disease. However, it is similar to mad cow disease. These are both diseases known as spongiform encephalopathies, which attack brain tissue and spinal cord tissue. And mad cow disease has killed a couple of hundred people, mostly in Great Britain, when it gets spread to human beings, where it's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. But that's mad cow disease. It is not chronic wasting disease, although they're related. And we need to make sure that people who are listening understand that there's a difference between the two, and chronic wasting disease cannot be spread to human beings.
What does it do to deer?
Well, it causes them to become very listless and to become emaciated, and eventually it kills them. It's nearly always fatal. And again, this is a disease that causes behavior problems, and it attacks the brain and spinal tissue, literally rotting it from the inside.
Have you heard at all any hypotheses or any theories as to how the CWD got onto that game farm, if not through some sort of external contamination?
They're still trying to figure that out. And what I was told by Rachel Klein, who is the public information official with the division that's involved with this, with the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, she says that they're called prions, which are an unnatural form of protein that spreads this disease. And if an animal gets it and dies, those prions go into the ground and they stay there forever. So what they're going to have to do right now is figure out how the disease got there, and then they're going to have to figure out to the extent to which it is spread to other animals in the herd and whether or not drastic measures are going to have to be taken. In terms of how chronic wasting disease got to Wisconsin, it wasn't even something that we had to deal with here until 2002, relatively recently. And the theory is that it originated out west and deer found a way to migrate here.
Hmm. Well, I'm wondering about the future of this farm in particular. If CWD is on the property, what would that mean for their ability to have future deer herds there?
That's a question that I don't know the answer of, and I don't know if the state officials know the answer to that one either. If worse comes to worse, they would have to kill all the deer on the property, from what I was told today. And then I guess if they want to continue using it as a hunting preserve, they'd have to start a new herd from scratch. And I don't know enough. I'm not a scientist to tell you the extent to which even that's something that's conceivable.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard at all in terms of the deer hunt that's been going on so far this season, whether this has been a huge issue for hunters right now, or is it too soon to tell?
I think, first of all, it's too soon to tell, and the indication that I have seen is that it hasn't been spread throughout the state of Wisconsin in the wild deer herd. We had concerns in the special zone that was set up in the southwestern portion of the state, but it made news earlier this year. In fact, it was very early in the year in January, where a couple of infected deer, wild deer, turned up, one in Portage County and one in Juneau County, both in central Wisconsin. And that kind of raised some eyebrows because they were outside of this zone. But I do not believe, and the authorities do not believe, that chronic wasting disease is something that's rampant throughout the entire deer herd and something most hunters have to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. What is your next step here in reporting this story?
Well, the next step is we see how the state investigation goes, and we see what they decide to do with the animals that are on that herd, the extent to which animals throughout that hunting preserve have been infected, whether or not they're all going to have to be destroyed, whether or not maybe this is just one isolated incident. And it's too soon to tell. Again, this is a story that just broke yesterday, so we're still waiting to see what happens.
Well, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, Cynthia, thanks so much.
Glenn Moberg is WPR's news reporter based in Wausau.
From the Book of Revelations to the Hunger Games, we humans have spent a lot of time thinking about the apocalypse and the dystopia that might come after. Our next guest has made his mark on the subject. He's Max Brooks, author of The Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z, which spun off a movie of the same name. His current comic book series is Extinction Parade. Max Brooks is speaking in Madison tonight, and he joins us now in the studio. Max, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So apocalypses are really bad, if I can understate a little. Why do we like to read about them and watch TV shows and movies about them?
Well, I think we're living in very uncertain times. I think the last time you had this deluge of apocalyptic media was the 1970s. You had Soylent Green and Ultimate Warrior and a little movie called Dawn of the Dead. Mm-hmm. And I think we instinctively want to explore the apocalypse when we see what we think is the system breaking down. And I think the 1970s was exactly like the time we're living in now. People had a sense that things weren't working. And I think it's human nature to look ahead and think, well, what's the end game? But it's also human nature to turn away if it's a little too real. So you put a little science fiction on there, you make the catalyst fake, say zombies, and then you can watch the apocalypse.
That's interesting. Is that part of the particular appeal of zombies, which are big in your works and obviously elsewhere?
Yeah, because, you know, zombies are not they're not a predatory metaphor, say the way a werewolf or a giant shark is, because you can just get away from those. If there's a giant shark in the water, don't go in the water. Zombies are really slate wipers. They really are apocalyptic. The stories are global, and I think they're a great metaphor for major global catastrophes, which we have been battered with, I think, the last decade.
And it seems like zombies can serve as a metaphor for whatever you need in a lot of ways. It could be the communists out there, or the consumer mindset here, or eco-disaster, or disease. Yes. It's a little bit of all of it.
What I find very interesting is I think they're a Rorschach test for whatever scares us. You know, I've done a lot of zombie panels and a lot of zombie interviews with a lot of zombie authors, but all these authors tend to be coming from fields of specialization. And they always have to put their specialist stamp on it. If someone studies viruses, they go, oh, no. It's a metaphor for plague. That's it. That's all. And then you've got economists who say, oh, no. This is for the financial meltdown. That's it. That's all. If you're watching Fox News, it says, no. It's liberals and people with college degrees.
So they're my zombies, whatever my turf happens to be. I'm going to take the zombies in and claim them as my own.
That's pretty much what I have seen in the last 10 years and watching the zombie culture flourish is people use it as an outgrowth for whatever really scares them.
Well, one thing you've been working on, I think, and the government has taken on is using fictional zombies to help prepare us for real disasters. How does that work?
Oh, definitely. And that's what I'm talking about tonight. 10 years ago, when I sat down to write Zombie Survival Guide, let me correct myself. It came out 10 years ago. I'm really getting old. I'm starting to do that old person thing where you sort of subtract 10 years to everything you say. I actually started writing it in the late 90s in response to Y2K. And when I was writing it, I realized everything in this book is no different than my earthquake disaster preparedness training. I mean, I live in L.A., and we've been preparing for earthquakes. So everything in my kit is my earthquake kit, and everything in my book is just preparing for a natural disaster.
Is it a sexier way to get us to think about natural disasters? We maybe don't take the real disasters as seriously. They're kind of boring.
I would do the reverse. I would say they're not sexy as far as they are safe. You know, if you go to a party and you say, hey, how would you guys survive a zombie apocalypse? It would be a lively discussion about bottled water and about preserving food and medical care and who would you need with certain specialist skills. And it would be an interesting night, yet an informative night. But you walk into a room and say, hey, I hear that AIDS just went airborne. How would we survive that? Bang, you would clear the room.
It would be the kind of a Debbie Downer approach to party conversation.
Well, you know, people instinctively turn away from things that are too scary. And that's why the CDC is so brilliant. I think it's the first time in my lifetime the federal government has been actually cool. Because what they've realized is this is a great way to get young people thinking about what to do in a quarantine. But you don't say an actual quarantine. You say zombies. But guess what? If these young people going on the website of the CDC and preparing a zombie kit, they're ready for a quarantine.
What other tips can we learn from the idea of a zombie attack or zombie quarantine that could apply for us in the real world for a real disaster preparation?
Well, if you look at any sort of natural disasters or man-made disasters, most people don't actually die of primary effect. What I call is if there's an earthquake, most people are not going to die in the actual earthquake. They're going to die of secondary and tertiary problems, disease, dehydration, starvation, accidents, which in my mind is exactly what would happen if there was a real zombie plague. Mm-hmm. For every person bitten by a zombie, there's a lot of people going to die of tetanus.
Right. So the water sanitation plant isn't open anymore in the zombie attack, and the grocery stores and the health clinics.
Exactly. What I've always said about zombies is they serve two purposes, if done right. They can, if done right, teach us what to do when the lights go out. But also, if done right, they can teach us why the lights stay on in the first place. And I think that's becoming more and more important for people. I think we need to really examine where civilization comes from. Where does the electricity come from? Who pipes the water into my house? Who pipes the poop out of my house? Who picks up my garbage so it doesn't pile up and infect me? There's a lot of systems that keep us clean and healthy and civilized, which would break down in a disaster.
So So by thinking about the absence in the case of the zombie attack, we learn to appreciate what we've got.
And I think that's very important now. I think, you know, we have a growing political forum in our country that calls for less government, which I'm sorry, to me sounds like less civilization. And as someone who has traveled around the world where I see a lot less civilization than we got, I'm very happy to have the poop piped out of my house, let me tell you.
Well, moving back to your fiction, you've added another layer of monster and maybe of metaphor in Extinction Parade. There's not just zombies now, as I understand it. There are vampires, too. How do they fit into the zombie world?
They, for me, fit perfectly into the zombie world because I've written so much about physical preparedness for a crisis. I've written about how would individuals prepare and how would governments prepare in World War Z. But this is emotional preparedness. This is the emotional, psychological survival kit that we carry in our hearts and our minds. And I've come to learn that that kit is built on struggle. That the more you struggle, the more you fail, the more you learn from your mistakes, the better equipped you are for life, for adversity that's going to come your way. And if you've never had to deal with that, you are not ready for anything, and that is my vampires. They are at the top of the food chain, apex predators. They've never had to struggle. They've never felt fear. They've never had to run for their lives, and therefore, they've never had to compensate. And so suddenly, here comes an existential threat. Their food is being eaten out from under them. What do they do as a species that has never had to struggle?
Resilience, it sounds like, is what I've heard it called by psychologists, having
yes.
that state of resilience, whether we're talking about humans or vampires.
And that, as I get older, becomes more important to me now that I'm a parent. And now that I see that there's a generation of young people coming up behind me where a good cross-section of them have never failed. They've been taught that they're awesome. And there's nothing in their way. Their parents go to job interviews with them. Their parents call up their professors and yell at them because their feelings were hurt. And it scares me because I think that doesn't prepare you for bad things that are going to knock on your door. And let's be honest, bad stuff happens no matter how coddled you are. And that to me is my vampires. They are the Kardashians, the Hiltons. They are this new generation that loves just wealth and success and joy and has never had to get their hands dirty.
Do you think that even if we don't face real-world examples of needing resilience, maybe rehearsing them through fiction, through vampires facing an ecological disaster, can teach us a little about it?
Well, I think that's what good science fiction should be. And I'm not saying that's me. I'm saying these are the people that inspired me. You know, I learned so much about life reading Robert Heinlein. And I learned about our government reading Tom Clancy. I think, you know, good science fiction, be it Star Trek or Twilight Zone, anything Richard Matheson throws up, really teaches us how to deal with life, or at least warns us that there's bad things waiting for us.
So your next project is a very different one. No zombies, no vampires. You're going back. It's the 100th anniversary coming up of World War I. Where does Harlem Hellfighters take us?
That is a story I've been trying to get out for about 15 years. And it's a true story. It's based on, my version is based on the true story of a group of African-American soldiers set up to fail by their own government, were then kicked over to the French army, who would take anybody at this point. They were so desperate. And these Americans, in spite of being set up to fail, became the most decorated, one of the most decorated units in the U.S. Army.
So I don't know if there's a line there from zombies and vampires to this, but the resilience theme, the overcoming adversity theme, really does seem to carry through there.
Oh, no. You want to talk about resilience. You want to talk about overcoming obstacles. I mean, these guys came out of that war as genuine heroes.
All right. We just have less than a minute left. Can you leave us with one or two tips on the off chance, fingers crossed, that there is an outbreak of zombieism?
Don't panic. Panic will kill you faster than any zombie. Just take a breath. Look around. You've been given this amazing brain by God or nature, whoever you want to give the credit to. Use your brain.
And that, I bet, could apply to any old disaster, too, even the real ones.
Even the real ones.
Max, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it. That was Max Brooks, author of World War Z and the Zombie Survival Guide. His new comic series is Extinction Parade. He's speaking tonight at, I think it's 7:30, at UW-Madison's Union South. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up next hour, it's our first installment of a new segment called Teach Me What You Know. This week, an entrepreneur will teach us how to start a business.
First, a look at a business that's behind much of the modern American diet, the meat industry.
Americans seem to have an insatiable appetite for meat, which stands at the center of most of our daily meals. But how did we get this way? A historian will join us to explain.
And we want to hear from you. Do you wonder where your meat comes from? Do you care about how the animal was raised, or do you simply want it to be cheap? Call in at 800-642-1234. And is meat a part of every dinner for you? Does it have to be there? Call us and tell us about it. It's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Maureen Ogle joins us now. She's a historian and author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Maureen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, many of our modern American meals are centered around meat as a main course. How did we get to become such a meat-loving culture?
We can trace it all the way back to those founding mothers and fathers during the colonial period. When European settlers came to the eastern seaboard of North America, they were coming from what we usually call the Old World, which for them was a world where food and land were both chronically scarce. But when they came to North America, they found what seemed to them to be an infinite amount of land, and they very quickly imposed on that land their definition of civilization, which included livestock husbandry and domesticated animals. And long before the American Revolution broke out in the late 18th century, the colonists in the British colonies in North America were widely known as being vociferous carnivores and were eating meat on a scale that visitors to the colonies found hard to believe, because even the poorest people were eating meat all the time on a regular basis.
Was that something that is different then from the land in which they came from? Was this a relatively new way of eating?
In where they had come from, certainly meat was prized and valued, but they had come from very land-scarce areas and also parts of the world where there was a very well-defined social hierarchy, social and political hierarchy. And those two things combined meant that average people rarely had enough to eat, let alone as much meat as they wanted. And so that's what changed when they came here. They were able to create a new meat-eating culture.
And you write that it was also a symbol of wealth, too, that they brought with them.
Yes. Well, it became real wealth for them. One of the things that colonists suffered from, well, and then after the Revolution, Americans as well, until the late 19th century, was a labor shortage. And livestock were, because there was so much land, people could simply let their stock graze freely, and it was quite easy for anyone to have, say, at least a steer, perhaps a couple of hogs, maybe a few sheep. And as a result, many people very quickly accumulated wealth in the form of livestock, which they could trade, or, of course, they could eat, but they could also trade. If it was a cow, for example, they could sell meat and cheese. So livestock also very quickly became a form of actual wealth to the people who lived in the colonies, of a sort that they would not have been able to enjoy access to in the Old World.
And are we talking about every household having livestock, or was it just, what percentage of the population had their own livestock?
Probably about 100, because at the time, of course, cities were not, at least not yet. They soon would be, and the cities would have a tremendous impact on how Americans thought about meat and how they made it. But during the colonial period, the small towns that served as ports through which goods were shipped back to the Old World and some goods into the New World were few and far between. And so virtually every household, regardless of where they lived and regardless of status, would have had some kind of livestock that they owned and they kept on their living space.
Well, and that certainly changed over time, as we know. Talk a little bit about when the act of raising and slaughtering and butchering our own animals and consuming meat became two distinct and very separate things.
After the American Revolution ended, Americans very quickly began to move off the eastern seaboard down into the Ohio River Valley first because there was a river and there were no roads, so that's how people traveled. But what Americans also began to do, rather to the surprise of many observers, was that they very quickly demonstrated a preference for living in town rather than on a farm, and that went hand in hand with Americans' efforts to construct their own independent economy, which meant they needed a manufacturing base. And manufacturing, by default, in a sense, created communities, so that cities began to grow very quickly. By the 1860s, when the Civil War broke out, already 25% of Americans, on average, were living in a city, and along the eastern seaboard, that percentage was much, much higher. As that happened, Americans made the great shift that altered the way their relationship with livestock production in particular, because city folks don't make their own food. That's something that's so obvious we tend to forget it. City people don't supply their own food. They can have backyard gardens, maybe there are urban gardens, but in general, city people rely on farmers. And so as urban populations grew, more and more people were living in circumstances in which they had no connection to, no immediate access to livestock, and certainly no connection to how food was raised.
Did that have any significant impact on the amount of meat that was eaten?
No. No, it did not. Americans very, very quickly developed a remarkably sophisticated system for raising livestock in rural parts of the country, and using railroads in particular, after the 1850s, using railroads. Before that, they herded livestock overland. For moving livestock into the great cities, which again were mostly at that time concentrated on the eastern seaboard, where those animals were slaughtered and processed and then distributed to butchers who then sold them to consumers.
Well, and family farms were, and still are, around, but maybe not in as great a prominence as they were historically. When did family farms begin to make way for large agribusiness?
Oh, how much time do we have? That's the great myth. I should stress here that I am a historian, and that was my only interest in writing this book. I knew absolutely nothing about any of it when I started, and I spent 7 years researching and writing the book. And I was surprised to discover that the claim that family farmers have been driven out by agribusiness and big corporations is just simply not true. The more accurate statement would be that family farmers have struggled since really the early 19th century to try to figure out how to feed this urban population that was outnumbering itself. Farmers have been a minority in this country for a very long time, and certainly throughout the entire 20th century, they've been a small minority. And the things that, like concentrated animal feeding operations, for example, the use of antibiotics and so forth, those kinds of things were not the products of big corporations who were trying to drive family farmers out. They were tools that were adopted and embraced by family farmers in the 20th century as they tried to figure out how to have a profitable farming operation that would feed the demands of a large urban population.
And so what we see then is just an evolution of that?
Yes. Before World War II in particular, Americans and farmers and city folks alike decided that really farming just had to be modernized because farmers simply weren't keeping up with demand. And not just in the United States. Americans have been shipping their agricultural products abroad, and global demand kept increasing as well. During World War II, there was tremendous pressure on farmers at a time when they had extraordinary labor shortages. I was genuinely surprised by that. There was tremendous pressure on farmers to embrace things like mechanization and automation to replace labor, which in turn made farms more and more like factories. Farms also got much bigger because farmers who simply didn't want to have a farm like that couldn't stay in business. So family farms became larger and larger operations. And in the 1970s, during a very complicated global economic situation that involved what was at the time regarded as a global famine, many corporations did decide much as I should say people are thinking today that, boy, there's going to be global pressure for food, agriculture will be a great investment. One of the quotes in the book that I used is that at the time, analysts were regarding agriculture as the new IBM, meaning it was a great place to invest. And many family farmers incorporated and increased their size again. Many of them decided to sell to corporations that came along with offers of money because corporations thought that they could make big money on it. But the other driving factor was that consumer demand became increasingly fragmented and specialized, and grocery chains, this is the thing that surprised me, grocery chains have an incredible amount of power dictating terms to meat packers and farmers alike. This is what consumers want. This is what we're going to buy, and we're not going to buy anything else. So give us these kinds of hogs, give us these kinds of cattle. And big farmers and then eventually corporate farmers were the ones that organized themselves to satisfy that demand.
Well, we'll pick up with that just after the break. We're talking with Maureen Ogle, historian and author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history, the past or present of the meat industry in the United States? Maybe you work in that industry. Are you a farmer with cattle, pigs? Are you a butcher? Do you work at a grocery chain dealing with meat? Call in and tell us your story at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We're talking with Maureen Ogle. She is a historian and author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America.
And we hope you'll join the conversation. Are you a vegetarian? Why did you become one? Or have you made the choice to not be a vegetarian? Why or why not? Or did you think about it at all? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Maureen, we have been talking about how our demand for meat has changed over time and how it's become a little bit more specialized, too. What do you think accounts for that, our evolution in our taste for meat?
I think, again, it was that very early colonial abundance. Americans, during the colonial period, it's clear from literary evidence and archaeological evidence that Americans who ate meat were eating whole animals. They ate organs, tongue, brain, so on and so forth. But in the 19th century, as supplies of meat increased and as more and more people moved to cities, what changed was the cuts of meat that Americans demanded. They refused to eat organs, tongue was off the table, brains and so forth, and started wanting only what we would think of them as normal cuts, steak, roast, and so on and so forth. Those became the cuts of choice, which made it difficult for meat packers because it meant that they had a great deal of the carcass that they weren't selling. So consumer demand has led to sort of higher-end taste palates and also put even greater pressure on the people who supply the meat, the mm-hmm. livestock, and the meat itself.
Well, we have been hearing from some people who are actually preparing meat while they listen to the program. Jim in Montello says he's listening to the show while butchering venison because it's a tradition this time of year in Wisconsin. It's very true. We also have Danny in Green Bay on the line. Hi, Danny.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to put a little perspective on how much actually is done per day. I work at a meatpacking plant in Green Bay, and we do about 2,200 head of cattle a day, and that's just out of the five plants that they own.
Wow. So you would estimate that out of the five plants, there are about 10,000 head a day?
Yeah, pretty much. We have, my company owns its own feedlots that have over 3,000 head of cattle on it per day.
Wow.
That sounds about normal.
Yeah.
that actually is probably a little bit on the low end even. One thing that's happened since really the 1960s when the byproducts that packers had relied on to subsidize the cost of meat, because remember, Americans don't eat the whole carcass, they only eat part of it. After World War II, and especially during the 1960s, the demand for those byproducts dropped. For example, hides from cattle there was not nearly enough as much demand for those because shoe manufacturers weren't making shoes of leather anymore. And so meatpacking plants changed at the time to eliminate every possible efficiency. The plants became much bigger, much more streamlined, much more automated. So that kind of output now would be probably toward the middle range of what a plant can put out.
Well, in the meantime, there's the cost to the consumer. As I assume that as the business becomes more efficient, then the meat becomes cheaper. But do you find that from a consumer's perspective that the consumer is more concerned about the quality of the meat or the cost of the meat?
The cost of the meat, there's no doubt. And I realize that probably flies in the face of what people expected me to say, particularly where you are. I live in Iowa, by the way. Yes, it's true that many people today want to eat organic meat. They want meat from local farms. They want free-range chickens or whatever. But those people are still a relatively small minority of the population. And one thing that I found when I researched the book was Americans and historically have become very upset when the price of meat goes even a little bit beyond what they think it should be. You know, it's not like there's a firm price. There's just some sort of mental price in their heads. Meat should cost X. And when it goes above that, I found case after case where Americans staged demonstrations, trashed butcher shops, went to Washington and demanded that, by God, the government had to do something about this. So it's definitely price. But for that price, Americans also want what they regard as quality. Now, to some people that might be an organic beef tenderloin from a farmer who lives 5 miles away. But in general, what people want is what they want. And what they want is very high-quality meats at a very low price.
Let's talk to Lauren in Janesville next. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
What's your comment?
Oh, my comment is, I guess I'm one of those customers who cares. I have been in the past a 17-year vegetarian. I did that largely because when I learned how animals lived and were processed, it was very upsetting to me in these contained feeding lots and such. I also live in Wisconsin, so I can see, as I'm driving now, a dairy farm with, I think, 6,000 cattle that never get outside at all. They stay in these 24-hour lit pole barns, and that's it. And right in front, they have the place where they put all their manure or whatever it is with the gas, the methane gas. But I prefer also, especially with GMO feed for the cattle and the antibiotics and such, I definitely will only eat grass-fed beef and grass-finished beef for those reasons. And I have lived in other countries where there's a lot more grass-fed. You mentioned our large pasture areas in this country, which is true. And I think it's moving a lot in that direction because I have numbers of friends, and certainly my family is definitely all grass-fed. And I've noticed that milk is coming out now in the stores that said it's called grass milk. So people are beginning to understand there's differences in the nutritional value, definitely differences in the taste, differences in whether you're getting antibiotics in your system that you don't want or getting GMO products in your system you don't want.
So there's a listener there who is more concerned about the quality of the meat or the animal products than the cost.
That's right. And again, there are many people like that today, but they're still a relatively small percentage. Perhaps it will make everyone feel better if I say that, I eat very little meat. After 25 years of vegetarianism, I just don't eat a lot of meat. I eat about 25 pounds a year. The average per capita in the U.S. is, I think, 225 pounds a year, which means somebody's eating a lot of meat.
Wow.
And I eat meat that is not raised using antibiotics. I'm not wild about grass-fed meat, so I don't eat that either. But I also realize that many people don't care about that, and they don't care enough to want to spend the price point, because there is a big price difference between conventional meat and, let's call it, small-scale meat. And as long as the demand remains so high in this country, and I don't see that that's going to change anytime soon, then meat manufacturers and livestock producers are going to be stuck with the system they have. The only way to, I think anyway, the only way to really make dramatic changes in the way meat is produced in this country is if demand just plunges. And then there won't be the need for these highly hyper-efficient systems that we use now, because those systems are designed to raise, in livestock, for example, to raise a lot of livestock on very little land, because agricultural land is extremely high-priced, and to do so with very little labor, because there is almost no agricultural labor available to farmers other than themselves. And the idea that somehow we can switch to small scale and feed everyone, I think is impossible, if only because we haven't got the land for pasture. Land is simply too expensive. It's not going to happen anytime soon, not on the scale at which we eat meat now.
Is the meat industry pushing back against hormones?
Hormones are used relatively little and almost entirely in cattle production. It's antibiotics that cause more grief for everyone. I will say that the science about antibiotics, so it's called subtherapeutic antibiotic use when you feed antibiotics to animals, and the reason farmers do this is because it allows animals to reach market weight much faster, and so it reduces their production costs. There's a tremendous amount of science, but mostly there's a lot of very political science. I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to, I have no idea whether we're affecting the evolution of bacteria because of the use of antibiotics or not. Mm-hmm. I don't know, so I'm not even going to wade into that one. No, of course, farmers would prefer not to use it because they know they would prefer not to have to use it, but they also know that if that's taken away from them, and everyone in the meat industry that I have talked to has said, yes, they expect antibiotics to be banned on the farm except for use by veterinarians. We'll find out what will happen. Presumably, the price of meat will go up. If the price of meat goes up enough, the good question is, will consumers reduce their demand?
Well, Maureen, thank you so much for shedding some light on this and for posing some interesting questions for us to think about.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
That was Maureen Ogle. She's a historian and author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America.